happen very often, but just sitting there in my office having a perfectly pleasant conversation with one of my colleagues. Jeff walks in, casually joins in the conversation, and then we realize, hey, it's time to do issues, etc. Maybe we should move this conversation up to the studio, which is precisely what we've done, just in time for the microphone to come on. We're going to be starting today's program talking with Serge Trifkovic about the parliamentary elections in Israel. Well, things have changed there. Not only has the government and the Palestinian Authority changed recently, but with the elections that were recently held there in the nation of Israel, the Israeli government has changed. And since it's a parliamentary system, a lot of questions remain to be answered about how the coalition is going to be put together. We're going to hear a news piece, on the parliamentary elections, and then we're going to be talking with Serge Trifkovic about it, foreign affairs editor for Chronicles Magazine, for the first half hour of Issues, etc. From 3:30 to 4:30, an hour of open lines for your questions and your comments. A question I want to raise with you is the three-year anniversary of the war in Iraq. Yes, it has been 3 years. We're going to hear a bit of the response of the news media to the three-year anniversary, and then I want to know from you, did you think we would be there 3 years? I mean, did you have the realistic expectation? Many people who know how war is fought thought 10 years minimum. And 10 years doesn't look that unreasonable at a point like this, but did you think we'd be there 3 years? And after 3 years, what's your assessment? If you were for it at the beginning, are you still for it at the same level? If you were against it, have you changed your mind, or are you still against it at the same level? We'll talk about the three-year anniversary of the war in Iraq during open lines, as well as share some other things with you then. Starting at 4:30, Dr. Uwe Simonetto is going to join us. These riots in France, my goodness gracious, looks like the country's just coming apart at the seams. What is this all about? Does the Muslim immigrant population in France have anything? These young Muslims who, in the past in France, have caused so much trouble, did they have anything to do with this? Uwe joins us to answer that question. And then, starting in the third hour of the program, Jennifer Roback Morris is going to be our guest. Among others, it seems to be a celebrity thing to do, the unwed, I wouldn't even call them unwed mothers yet, unwed celebrities wanting to adopt children. The latest, Jessica Simpson. She wants babies. We'll hear a piece, and Jennifer will respond. We'll talk a little bit about fatherless adoption. I just heard a news piece the other day about motherless adoption, too. Interesting. Unwed fathers is what they're calling them. That's an odd term. And then Ben Witherington joins us for the last 40 minutes of the program. Well, it was the Da Vinci Code. It was Holy Blood, Holy Grail, then the Da Vinci Code, and then the latest is called, The Supper Secret? We're going to be talking about Leonardo da Vinci's painting, The Last Supper and the Da Vinci Code, with Dr. Ben Witherington in the last part of Issues, etc. Our call-in numbers for these 3 hours, 505-7850. 1-800-730-2727. We start out with a piece on the parliamentary elections in Israel. Things are still shaping up, but the elections are over. Let's listen.
Now comes the hard part. The morning after declaring victory, incoming Prime Minister Ehud Olmert now faces the challenge of pulling together a coalition from a severely splintered parliament and somehow winning over apathetic, disillusioned Israelis. A record number of Israelis didn't bother to vote at all, and a great many voted for obscure outside parties. That's going to make it a whole lot harder to build on the vision of Ariel Sharon's Kadima Party of pulling out of the West Bank and redrawing Israel's borders by 2010.
It includes the establishment of a Palestinian state on the side of an Israeli state, the end of terror, and the marking of permanent borders.
But it'll be a tough sell, not only to the Israelis. Olmert will have to persuade Palestinians the pullout is in their best interest, too. And their message has been loud and clear.
The incoming Palestinian prime minister has already rejected the plan. And with the militant group Hamas now running the show, refusing to even recognize Israel's right to exist, a peace partnership seems unlikely.
Makes me sad. I don't see much prospect for peace at the moment.
It's that sense of hopelessness Kadima will try to change. Translated, Kadima means forward, and the feeling is better that than standing still. Charlie Daggett, CBS News, Jerusalem.
All right, there's the piece. Joining us to talk about the parliamentary elections in Israel, Serge Trifkovic. He's a regular guest. He's foreign affairs editor for Chronicles, a magazine of American culture. Serge, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Good to be with you again.
What has changed, if anything, with the latest round of elections in Israel?
Well, first of all, I think it's noteworthy that that Likud has suffered a debacle. And I wouldn't be surprised if Netanyahu were to be ousted in the foreseeable future. They only have 11 seats in the 120-member Knesset. Also, the volatility of the electorate. For instance, the Pensioners' Party, which literally came into being only a month ago, managed to get 7 seats. And they started with minimal funds and practically no media exposure. I don't think it will be too hard for Kadima to put together a coalition. Labor has already indicated its readiness to go along with the plan to disengage from part of the West Bank. And I'm pretty certain that Shas, one of the ultra-Orthodox parties, will go along too. The real challenge will be how to get an interlocutor on the Arab side, because let's face it, if you're looking at a package that entails turning the present separation fence into the new border of Israel, then no Arab could conceivably sign on the dotted line and expect to live very long.
So is it safe to say that when Ariel Sharon lapsed into the coma, is it safe to say that his plan for withdrawal from Western Bank and all this, is proceeding under different leadership as he would have foreseen it?
Well, in the broad outline, Olmert has already indicated that all of the key ingredients of the original Sharon package stand. And I wouldn't like to bore your listeners with details, but it is really important to stress that major settlements such as Maale Adumim, just outside Jerusalem, would certainly stay in Israel, or rather would be included or annexed when the final border is set. Also the Gush Etzion block south of Jerusalem. And also Olmert has pledged that Jerusalem would remain Israel's united capital, which is at sharp odds with the stated intention of the Palestinians to have East Jerusalem as the capital of their putative state. And finally, and this is very important, Olmert has said that Israel would not evacuate the Jordan Valley, which means that it would still retain physical control of the border between the Palestinian state and Jordan. So all of these elements have already been in place under Sharon, and I think it's rather ironic that we discuss the policy and the intended plan of Kadima as a centrist or moderate one, because to all intents and purposes, I think it's a pretty hardline plan. It basically envisages annexing an additional 18% to 20% of the West Bank into the final boundaries of Israel. And it does not allow for the physical point of contact between the future Palestinian state and its Arab neighbors.
Now, American evangelicals were kind of hoping for the return of Benjamin Netanyahu after Sharon fell ill. That, of course, has not happened. How do you expect American evangelicals who view the modern state of Israel as the Israel of Bible prophecy to react to these latest elections?
Well, I'm trying to look at it in strictly technical terms. What is the best chance for Israel to survive in the long term? And I think it would be strictly in terms of a peace package that would be acceptable to the Arabs. Because let's face it, a state that exists as an armed camp and that is susceptible to terrorist attacks and to the kind of siege mentality that only breeds the sense of insecurity that the creation of Israel was supposed to resolve, is not the kind of Israel that has the dynamics of safe, secure, and open-ended existence. So some kind of compromise has to be made. And let's also not forget that the same applies to the Arabs, because in strictly Islamic terms, any territory that had once been part of Dar al-Islam and reverts to Dar al-Harb must be reconquered. And for that reason, Hamas still maintains its very hardline position, denying Israel's right to exist. So quite apart from metaphysical issues involved, I think that ultimately, if there is going to be a peace settlement, it would have to be the one that would fall short of the maximalist biblical demands by one party or the Quranic demands of the other.
Is Hamas, is the position of Hamas, or do we know at this point whether their position is this land was Dar al-Islam and it will be again one way or the other? Is that still their stated position?
Yeah, they haven't really given up on they haven't revised their charter, and it is one of the key demands by the Israelis before they agreed to talk to them. I think their strategy in the short term will be to use Abbas as the interlocutor for any future talks with the Israelis, because basically they know that if Abbas delivers an acceptable deal, then they can go along with it, and if he doesn't, then he will be blamed. So they're, for the time being, in the context of Palestinian politics, in a very strong position. They can afford to let Abbas talk to the Israelis, and then they, at any moment in time, they can deny having anything to do with it.
We hear the term bandied about quite often here in the United States, neoconservative. What does this term usually mean, and what will the neoconservative reaction be to these parliamentary elections in Israel?
Well, the neocons have had very close relationship with Likud and with Netanyahu himself. For instance, the leading lights of the neocon movement, such as Richard Perl and Douglas Feith, have prepared the memorable 1996 paper for Netanyahu on the Israeli strategy. And I think that they will be opposed to any attempt to impose the solution on the settlers, with whom they are very close. But at the same time, I think that it is in the interest of the United States to encourage the sort of approach that Kadima will follow over the years to come. And it is falling short of the maximalist demands of the old Likud leadership, because let's not forget, the present Kadima actually includes quite a sizable chunk of the electorate that used to vote Likud in the past.
So when, just to kind of put the bow on that last point, when Sharon split from Likud, it sounds like he took the better part of his loyal followers with him into Kadima.
Indeed, but on the other hand, it is also an inherent weakness of the Kadima, because with Sharon incapacitated, it's obvious that that others are not quite capable of projecting the same strong image and motivating people to the same level of personal loyalty. So that even though they had originally been expected to get 40, 42 seats in the Knesset, they only managed to scrape about 28.
Now, this is, I mean, I need you to explain this odd alliance that has been formed between the neocons, the neoconservatives, and many American evangelicals. What is it that holds them together, and what are their common goals when it comes to the issue of the Middle East?
Well, it's a long story, and I would say that the most characteristic feature of the neoconservative approach to this odd alliance is utter cynicism, because they're the kind of people that do not really have much time for Christianity in the public place. They do not cherish the continuity of Christian values and traditions and mindset that have been the defining feature of this country ever since the 13 colonies came into being. But they are exploitative when it comes to the political usage of what they regard as something that they care very much about, which is, of course, the support for not only Israel per se, but for the particular option within Israel that is embodied in Likud and the settler movement.
Why are the neocons in support of Israel? I know why many American evangelicals are, but why are the neocons in support of Israel?
Well, you see, partly with many of them, it is a matter of personal commitment, and partly I would say it is part of the desire to have a permanent engine, a permanent source of tension that will justify the American role as what some of their ideologues would call benevolent global hegemon. The term benevolent global hegemony was coined by Robert Kaplan and William Kristol a few years ago in an article in Foreign Affairs Journal that really provides the blueprint for their mindset. And I would say that they need regional sources of instability as a sort of self-justifying catch-22. For as long as the Middle East is unstable, we need to maintain a strong military, just as for as long as, for instance, the Taiwan issue remains unresolved, and for as long as Cuba is ruled by Castro. So it's a form of self-justifying, self-fulfilling prophecy. The world is unstable, and therefore we need to maintain and keep the ability to project power to any corner of the globe at any moment in time.
So it keeps the American foot in the door, the instability.
Indeed, yes. And I think it's ultimately short-sighted because sooner or later you reach the point of imperial overreach. And people should realize that maintaining the size of the military that we have at the moment with the price tag that we all know about, and yet it wouldn't be able to, for instance, occupy and keep Iran occupied for any length of time. Even Iraq, where you have what in military terms can only be called low-level insurgency, the manpower resources are strained and the political consensus behind the war is declining. So I think it would be extremely important to bear in mind that the neocons are playing with fire and that in the long term their notions of imperial grandeur have nothing to do with pragmatically defined national interests of the United States or the aspirations of most ordinary Americans.
We're talking about the parliamentary elections in Israel. Sergei Trifkovic is our guest. He is foreign affairs editor for Chronicles, a magazine of American culture. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. In about 15 minutes, open lines for your questions, your comments, but also your answer to this question. Is the war in Iraq a just war? 3 years anniversary of the war in Iraq. It'll dovetail nicely with our conversation here with Sergei. Sergei, is there religious freedom in Israel? We've been hearing a lot about the lack of religious freedom in Afghanistan. What about in our ally, Israel?
Well, it's a somewhat ambivalent and one might say a paradoxical situation that whereas American Jews are generally identified with the liberal side of political divisions and advocate complete tolerance and quite rightly so, when it comes to certain idiosyncrasies of the Israeli situation, and in particular the law of return, which very openly discriminates between people on the grounds of their ethnicity and their religion, they're strangely muted. So what we have is the kind of dual standard that probably would not be allowed vis-a-vis any other country anywhere else. But again, to be frank, I have to admit that personally, having been there a few times, I see no way for Israel to survive in the long term unless it maintains this degree of ethno-religious exclusivity, because the dynamics of demography are such that it would simply be a matter of time before the Muslim minority within Israeli boundaries, in particular in the northern part of the country, in Galilee, reaches 25 or 30%. And in combination with the possibility that some 700,000 or 800,000 Palestinians who were expelled in 1947-48 would seek to resettle in Haifa or in Tel Aviv or Western Jerusalem, then the writing on the wall would be very grim indeed. So when you have the choice between principles of anti-discriminationism, inclusiveness, tolerance, etc., and survival, I think that that most Jews would quite wisely opt for the latter.
What is the state of Christians in Israel, be they Palestinian Christians or otherwise? Are Christians allowed to proselytize?
No, and I have to admit that the situation is really melancholy. For instance, so many American evangelicals go to Israel and they visit the holy places, but they don't really make an effort to find out what's going on with Christianity in the land of its birth. And the sad fact is that while the Israelis and overwhelmingly Muslim Arabs have been battling it out, the Christian communities, not only in Israel, but also in the Palestinian occupied territories and in the surrounding lands, have dwindled to almost nothing. At the moment, for instance, the Christians comprise only about 2% of the Arab Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, whereas back in the late 1940s, that number was closer to 22%. And also, if you look at the situation of the Copts in Egypt or the Maronites in Lebanon, everywhere the picture is grim. It's a downward spiral, and the one that's before too long will probably leave nothing more than relics and memories without a vibrant living community of faith.
With only 30 seconds here, do you expect the present U.S. administration to address the issue at all in with its ally of religious freedom, especially for Christians?
I would be very surprised, because on past form, I don't think that for a variety of reasons, political as well as principled, Mr. Bush would do it, at least not publicly.
Sergei Trifkovic is our guest. He's foreign affairs editor for Chronicles, a magazine of American culture. You can read his articles at the website address for Chronicles Magazine. It's chroniclesmagazine.org, chroniclesmagazine.org. Sergei, thank you very much for being our guest.
My pleasure.
Well, when we come back from this break, a bit of that conversation segues nicely in the direction I'd like to go for open lines. We're going to be hearing a piece on the third anniversary of the war in Iraq. I remember when it started, don't you? It wasn't that long ago. One of the questions that we asked again and again and again when the war was starting, on the way up toward war, after the war had begun, is this a just war? Now, many of you chimed in at the time. Yes, no, don't know. Have your views changed after 3 years? Do you think the war in Iraq is a just war? Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Open Lines is next. We're going to hear just a piece on various theologians, philosophers talking about the issue 3 years out. Has the time, the passage of 3 years, changed your mind on this at all, for or against? Has the way that the war has unfolded started quickly? The military action continues at a slow burn. The insurgency now seems to kind of hold the cards on any given day. Has your mind changed on the Iraqi war? Is it just? Your answer to that question when we come back from this break, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It's open lines when we come back. Dr. Uwe Simonetto will join us at 4:30 to talk about the riots in France. Does the Islamic factor play any part in these riots, the latest that we're hearing about so much? And then we'll be talking with Jennifer Roback Morse about fatherless adoption and Ben Witherington about Leonardo da Vinci's famous painting.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc. You'll find lots of wonderful illustrations in our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for March. It's titled, He is Risen Indeed. This picture book for children ages 4 and up depicts the drama of Passion Week in words from Scripture. He is Risen Indeed is published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about this book on our website, issuesetc.org. He is Risen Indeed costs $12.99 plus shipping and handling. David Erickson's paintings capture the events of Good Friday and Easter morning in He is Risen Indeed. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org. He is Risen Indeed will help children learn about Jesus' suffering, death, and resurrection. Looking for an Easter gift for a young child, grandchild, or godchild? He is Risen Indeed, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org.
Now listen to this African proverb, when the hyena grabs, he never lets go. This Global Minute reflects on the families in Zambia who are suffering from AIDS and asks you to pray. Zambia and Malawi are among the countries hardest hit by AIDS. In many cases, both the mother and father have died, leaving orphans behind. Local churches are trying to cope, and the mission agency Action International Ministries is helping. There are various outreach projects to bring comfort and to let children and their parents hear about Christ's love. Christians who love children and have many different types of skills can travel to Zambia and help. Pray for local pastors and missionaries with Action International Ministries to have Christ's wisdom as they forge ahead. Learn what you can do to share Christ around the globe. Visit www.actionintl.org. Actionintl.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. The late August Menicky wrote, "Our daughter shared a conversation she overheard at home. Our three-year-old grandson was standing at the basement stairs, trying to muster enough courage to make the descent. Before taking the first step, he said, 'Oh, Jesus, it's awful dark down there. You had better hold my hand.'" In the 19th century, the poet John Greenleaf Whittier also wrote about a three-year-old, and really about us adults. "A tender child of summer's three, seeking her little bed at night, paused on the dark stair timidly. 'Oh, mother, take my hand,' said she, 'and then the dark will all be light.'" We older children grope our way from dark behind to dark before, and only when our hands we lay, dear Lord, in thine, the night is day. Reach downward to the sunless days, wherein our guides are blind as we, and faith is small, and hope delays. Take thou the hands of prayer we raise, and let us feel the light of thee. Psalm 37, verse 5 says, "Commit thy way unto the Lord." I'm Dale Meyer.
You've heard us talking about our high-definition broadcast. Now hear what a listener is saying about the new sound of AM 850 KFUO. Jim in Cottage Hills, Illinois, writes that the sound was pretty, quiet, and spacious. He says, "I want you to know you have a listener to your HD broadcasts, and I hope more stations will follow transmitting with HD. Well, if you'd like to learn more about high-definition receptor radios, visit our website, click on the HD link at kfuo.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Open lines in just a moment. First, there are going to be some retreats held on the campus of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, this spring. What do you call it? Spring? Early summer. A confirmation retreat on the Lord's Prayer. It's going to be read by the Reverend John Dreyer. He's a regular guest on the program here. He's a good friend up there. And then Dr. John Seleska. You all know that name. He's been on the program a lot of times and for many years. Also in May, holding a biblical world retreat, Christ in the Old Testament. Now, let me just give you a little preview. Actually, I could never do him justice. But if you wanted someone who has an encyclopedic knowledge of Scripture, who can quote chapter and verse right off the top of his head, rapid-fire succession, bring it all together to show you so clearly how even the Old Testament is also the cradle that holds Christ, that's Dr. John Seleska. That's what you will get at one of these Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, spring retreats. For more information, all you've got to do is call them, 1-877-287-4338, 1-877-287-4338, or you can visit our website, issuesetc.org, and look for the logo for Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, issuesetc.org. All right, here's the question. We used to ask this a lot, about 3 years ago, but it's time to ask it again because this is the third anniversary of the war in Iraq. Did you believe at the time we went to war that it was a just war? Or did you believe that it wasn't? Has your mind changed after 3 years either way? Is the war in Iraq a just war? Will it reach a point, say, when we reach the 10th anniversary, if it goes that long, where you're going to say to yourself, just or not, let's just get out? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address. Feel free to write us an email. We had a lot yesterday. Issues ETC at KFUO.org. Here's a piece from PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly on the third anniversary of the war in Iraq and the question of whether or not it is just.
At the Roman Catholic Sacred Heart University in Fairfield, Connecticut, Professor Brian Stiltner teaches a course on faith and justice. Today, his class is discussing what constitutes a just war and whether the Iraq War qualifies.
Do you feel it was the right thing to do?
We went in with the wrong intentions, and us being there now, it's making the situation worse.
I think we are in there for a good purpose. Like, something is getting done, even though it is taking, like, a long time.
The answers aren't always easy, which Stiltner knows all too well.
I personally took an ethical position in favor of the war at the beginning, but have since had serious misgivings and think it was ethically not justified. But I've been wrestling with those issues. I think part of ethics is wrestling. It's really appropriate with this complex war and long engagement to keep looking back at what we knew then, what we knew now, and asking whether we would have made the same decisions.
3 years after the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq, theologians and ethicists are assessing whether the military action was indeed morally justified. They're debating if a preemptive war can be a just war and what ethical principles should guide the decision to leave Iraq. The widely accepted moral framework for the discussion is the just war tradition, a set of teachings that began with St. Augustine in the 4th century and were further developed by St. Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century. The tradition says in order for a war to be just, there must be a just cause. It must be declared by the proper government authority. There must be a right intention and a probability of success. War must be a last resort, and the means used should be proportional to the desired ends. Dr. Richard Land heads the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention. In September 2002, he told this program he believed an attack against Iraq would be justified under the criteria for a just war. He stands by that today.
You'd have to have a just cause. Our cause was not to conquer Iraq, but to liberate it. It was to defend ourselves and our allies from the possibility of future attacks from a man who has shown a willingness to cooperate with and to train tens of thousands of terrorists and to give them safe harbor.
Land says the benefits being achieved outweigh the destruction being caused.
I think it's one of the nobler and finer things we've done as a nation, and I think that it's going to, in the end, produce a government in Iraq and a society in Iraq that is far more conscious of human rights and far more conscious of human freedom. And in the end, it's going to remake the Middle East.
Also on our September 2002 program, Professor Sean Casey of Wesley Theological Seminary disagreed with Land. He says the facts have confirmed his position.
They said our cause was just, and they argued under a global war on terrorism that there were weapons of mass destruction, there were links to terrorism, which we now know are not true. The president never made a full-blown case in the categories of the just war ethic to justify this invasion.
Casey says the just war teaching that force should be a last resort was widely ignored.
Last resort says if you have any peaceable avenues to pursue that might be fruitful, you have to try those avenues and exhaust them first. And clearly that was not the case in our invasion of Iraq.
William Galston is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington. 3 years ago, he was also among those arguing that the war wasn't morally justified. Now, he worries about its long-term moral impact.
I am calling the failure of events to bear out our case for going to war a loss of moral credibility and therefore of moral authority and therefore of operational capacity in future foreign policy.
Professor Stiltner initially supported the invasion as morally acceptable because the just war ethic does allow for the use of force in the face of a grave and imminent threat. Weapons of mass destruction in the hands of Saddam Hussein, he believed, was such a threat.
We can all see now in retrospect that the war wouldn't have been necessary to protect us from any kind of substantial weapons program, any kind of imminent use.
Jean Bethke Elstein teaches social and political ethics at the University of Chicago Divinity School.
For me, the fact that WMD haven't been found is not a trump card that obliterates all the other moral and ethical considerations that I think we need to keep in the mix as we talk about this.
She says the just war theory permits the use of force to stop massive human rights abuses, and she believes the situation in Iraq under Saddam Hussein met that standard.
What we loosely call humanitarian intervention. In the classic just war teaching, it's protecting the innocent from certain harm. The data on what was going on in Iraq was horrid and overwhelming.
Elstein admits the number of U.S. troops and Iraqi civilians killed since the war began has been what she calls a terrible cost. She still believes proportional good has been achieved, but says she will reassess that if the situation doesn't stabilize.
If you go through the upheavals of a war and what you wind up with is some kind of civil war that goes on without end, then you can look back and say this was likely a mistake. And if that happens, it will have been a mistaken judgment on my part and a lot of other people's.
The Bush administration has embraced what it calls a strategy of preemptive war. This has prompted vigorous ethical debate. Galston says there is an important distinction between a preemptive war against an imminent threat and a preventive war, which he believes was the case with Iraq.
There is very little theory or modern moral argument that supports a preventive war when the threat is more distant in time and more speculative.
If you accept, as part of the just war tradition, sparing the innocent from certain harm, that means you've got to act before that harm comes. And that means prevention in certain situations.
The people who died in the Twin Towers on 9/11 and their family members would probably say that the pre-9/11 definitions of when preemptive force would be justified need to be expanded, and I would agree with them.
Imagine a world where the threat or the enmity between the two nations was in fact just cause. The hypothesis that they might be dangerous to me, if that becomes a warrant for preemptive or preventive war, the entire globe becomes a bloody sea of chaos.
The just war ethic says less about how to end a conflict and what to do afterward. Elstein believes the principles need to be expanded to include ideas about what she calls a just occupation that leads to a peaceful, ordered society.
I think that's our obligation as an occupying power, is to do our very best to see if we can leave Iraq with something like that working, knowing that it finally, to sustain it, is not going to be our job over the long run. That has to be their job.
I think the ethic says you have to minimize your footprint there, and you want to get out as soon as you can whenever you intervene.
The Iraqis believe it was worth it. They are dying, standing up and being willing to die for their country every day, and I believe we have a moral obligation to stand with them until they can defend themselves.
The just war ethic has been a moral template for more than 1,000 years, but using it to weigh the facts on the ground is always complicated.
It's not like having a tick list and you say, okay, tick, 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 adds up to this, home free, you know, and you just leave it behind. You have to ongoingly be in the process of making judgments and assessments.
You always sort of cross your fingers, hold your breath, and say a prayer when you're bringing these moral arguments to bear on issues as grave as war and peace.
I'm Kim Lawton reporting.
All right, that's the PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly piece reflecting, after 3 years of war in Iraq, on whether or not the war itself is just. What do you think about this? We talked to you about this 3 years ago, all around the beginning, during the inception, after it began. Is the war in Iraq just? Did it start out to be just and then change into something else? Has your viewpoint changed? It's open lines 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. In that piece, you heard the whole spectrum of opinions on this, from the very optimistic and Richard Land saying, look, it was a good thing. It started out well. It's progressed well. It's accomplishing good things. And he said it's going to remake the Middle East. It's going to turn out, as he said, to be one of the most noble things that the United States has done. That's one end of the spectrum. Others quite doubtful that the war was ever just to begin with or is now. What do you think? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We're coming to you live this Wednesday. Yeah, it's Wednesday, the 29th of March. Our call-in numbers again, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We'll talk a little bit about just war theory as the hour progresses as well. And our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Now, just war theory has kind of grown over its long history. The first to ever really put it into a theory is Augustine, who had a very simple, elegant three parts, if I remember them correctly. It would have been just authority, or that is, rightful authority. I can't say, hey, I don't like what my neighbor has done. I'm going to go to war with him. I have no authority to do such a thing. There has to be a rightful authority to declare this war, to carry it out. And usually that authority is nations. That's kind of the rough lines we've drawn there. Then there is just cause. This is the one that's tricky because most people will say, well, of course the United States has a right to defend itself. Most people would say that. And they have a right to make war when necessary. But the thing we all get caught up in is just cause. When is the cause just? Well, let's look at there are cases where we could say the cause was just. Most would agree that our entrance into the Second World War had just cause. Number one, we'd been attacked on the eastern side. And number two, I'm sorry, on the western side. And on the eastern side, we had allies who were fairly well begging us for the last 3 years to come and help them. It was either come to our allies' aid, and in this case, England, Great Britain, or watch them be exterminated or subjugated to Nazi rule. It had to come down to that. So we say the cause was just for the entrance there. But this is a tough one to figure out. I mean, this is a tough one to sort out, especially while the war is going on. Now, remember, just war isn't just I feel justified in supporting this war. That's not what it's about. It's more objective than that. Now, the third that I think Augustine would have laid out was the principle of discrimination. And that is, you just don't make war, total war, willy-nilly. Again, the example would go back to the Second World War. The Germans, the Nazis, had a policy of total war. They called it Blitzkrieg. It meant they made war, and they made war completely. And in some cases, in many cases, they didn't discriminate between the military and civilians, between combatants and non-combatants, if it served their purposes. Eventually, the Allies were even pushed to a similar response. So, based on those three things, just authority, just cause, and discrimination between who we kill and who we try not to kill, do you think that the Iraqi war is just? We've had guests on the show who've advocated for both sides. Guests who've said, no, it's not a just war. And guests who've said, yes, it is a just war. I want to know what you think. 3 years since we began. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Now, your mind might have changed on this, or you might not be sure. That's fine. Give us a call. We begin with Linda, who calls from Farmington. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Pastor. Well, I don't know enough about politics to even probably say much, but I do have two sons. You know, my youngest son is making a career out of the Air Force. And he's been in a war, you know. But from what I remember, this war started over here. And I'm so thankful for the people who are giving their lives to keep it from continuing to be fought here. Because, you know, September 11th, you know, we don't know exactly, you know, where that was coming from. We weren't ready for it. But I thought, is this what it's going to be like? You know, is this what it's going to be like here in this country now? Is this going to be a war zone, you know? I saw people lining up at the filling stations that day. It was just like a nightmare. And I'm so thankful, you know, that you know, we're not living in that war, and it could, you know, what are our alternatives? I don't know, you know, if you could call it a just war, but our alternative is that the war would be fought here, and we would have more devastation here, which that might sound selfish, but...
No, I don't think so, Linda. Linda, thank you very much. All right. Now, what Linda is expressing is what actually has been expressed. It was expressed at the time of September 11th and since, and even expressed by the Bush administration when we were leading up to war. They said, we fight there or we fight here. We have a choice. Now, we don't want to fight here, so we have to fight there. Now, it took almost 3 years for the Bush administration to come out and say, we have a policy of preemptive war. You know when they said it officially? 2 weeks ago. We have a policy of preemptive war. And the president was out for about a week defending his policy of preemptive war. That is, so that we don't have to fight here, we fight there. Or if we see a threat and we, the best guess says this threat is not going to decrease but increase and it may come to us, then we need to act first to protect ourselves. It's based upon self-defense. So Linda's not sure whether it's just or not, but she doesn't see a lot of alternatives. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org, issuesetc@kfuo.org, and our call-in numbers, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, is the War in Iraq Just. Let's talk with Gary, who calls from his car. Hi, Gary.
Well, good afternoon. At the beginning, whenever this all started, my firm belief was if the president, whoever he may be, thinks that it protects our shores, then he has to do what he has to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I still stand by that.
You still do?
Yes.
Has your position ever, I mean, just be honest, has your position ever wavered or have you had doubts?
Have I ever wavered?
Well, in regard to this war in the last 3 years?
No.
Right.
I firmly believe that the president was making a decision to protect the United States, and I believe that.
Just be honest, if it were a different president, if it weren't President Bush, but it were, in fact, let's say, push it back just a year and a half, if it had been during the administration of President Clinton, do you think your position would have been the same and remained the same?
Whenever Clinton went into his little deal over there, I was for that particular cause also, because just being a mere, my brain's kind of gone blank, a citizen of the United States, I have to rely on the president making decisions for the best of us.
All right, Gary, thank you. Thank you, Gary. Thanks for listening. There are no mere citizens. We are the government of this country. All right, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Linda is not sure. Gary is sure, was sure, and still is sure. Let's see what Tim has to say. He's calling from his car. Tim, welcome.
Yes, Todd. I think the Lord has revealed a lot of falsehood since this war has begun. You know, for a long time, they got to say that they were, because of the weapons of mass destruction, we found that that wasn't true. George Bush kept referring to 9/11 as the reason, when 19 of the plane hijackers were Saudi Arabian. You know, I think these scandals such as the Abai guy, prisoner, however you pronounce it, how the mistreatment of prisoners, the fact that you have people that haven't been charged with a crime that are being held for years.
Well, now, Tim, you know. Tim, let's, our time is short and there are others waiting. Is it unjust or is it just?
Well, it's totally unjust. I think it's totally, a Christian would know that, okay?
All right, Tim, thank you. I don't know. See, that's why I'm asking the question. I don't know that Christians necessarily have to all agree on this question. I don't know that they can all agree. So we've got, hey, this is perfect, three calls. We've got one yes, it's just, one no, it's unjust, and one, Linda, saying, I'm not sure. Bill calls from Southern California, listens on the Internet. Bill, welcome.
Hi, Todd. You know, I strongly feel that the war is unjust. When we first started going to war, I did a lot of research on books that were written about Christians in war and Christian historical attitudes towards war. And also as part of that, I read a book by Walzer called Just and Unjust War. And in that, I really came away with a feeling that this war isn't just. But just recently I read a book called Assassin's Gate, and that discusses the history of war, I mean the history of Iraq in this situation. And it's really a complex issue, but I still feel that the war is unjust.
Now, so let me get you straight. You believed at the time we went in 3 years ago that it was not just, and that opinion has simply been confirmed by circumstances and your further study of the issue.
Yes.
All right.
But one other thing I wanted to add is that, you know, in this book, Assassin's Gate, they really talk about the tragedy of what's going on with the Iraqi people both before and after the war. And we as Christians, we as Americans as well, really need to look at what they're going through and really have a dialogue about that and how to solve some of the injustices in the Muslim world.
Bill, thank you very much. Well, we talk about that quite a bit here on the program. Part of the problem there, of course, is Islam. It's not the only problem, but that is a big part of the problem. So what about the rest of you? Two of our callers, Bill and Tim, say, no, this is not a just war. They never really thought it was. Gary says, yes, he always thought it was, still does today after 3 years. Linda just simply remembers 9/11 and says, I don't know what our alternatives were, but she's not sure whether it's just or unjust. It's open lines, issues, etc. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And our in-studio email address is issues@kfuo.org. We check the email every few minutes here in the studio, and if you email us a question or a comment, an answer to this question, your thoughts, sometimes you write them better than you say them, we'll read them right here on the air. Jim calls from St. Louis. Jim, welcome.
Yes, thank you for taking my call, Pastor.
Sure.
I think that it's impossible for the average person. And then if the person happens to be a theologian, it's very easy to understand the arguments. But I don't think the vast majority of the politicians would care. And then those that really know the politics don't care to understand the arguments. And then on top of it, I really believe, impossible to prove this, that there's an oligarchic plutocracy.
Now, Jim, I got to go because our time is short here. Just war, yes or no?
Can't discern the truth.
Can't discern it. All right, so he'd fall roughly, for different reasons, into Linda's category. That's two, don't know, can't tell the truth. One, yes, it's a just war. And two, absolutely not. What about the rest of you? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We'll be right back with Open Lines after this.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.